You could have lots of analytical intelligence and very little practical intelligence, or lots of practical intelligence and not much analytical intelligence, or, as in the lucky case of someone like Robert Oppenheimer, you can have lots of both. So where does something like practical intelligence come from? We know where analytical intelligence comes from. It's something, at least in part, that's in your genes. Chris Langan started talking at 6 months. He taught himself to read at 3. He was born smart. IQ is a measure, to some degree, of innate ability. But social savvy is knowledge. It's a set of skills that have to be learned. It has to come from somewhere. And the place where we seem to get these kinds of attitudes and skills is from our families. Perhaps the best explanation we have of this process comes from the University of Maryland sociologist Annette Leroux, who a few years ago conducted a fascinating study of a group of third graders. She picked both blacks and whites, and children from both wealthy homes and poor homes, zeroing in, ultimately, on 12 families. Leroux and her team visited each family at least 20 times for hours at a stretch. She and her assistants told their subjects, "Just treat us like the family dog." And they followed them to church and to soccer games and to doctor's appointments with a tape recorder in one hand and a notepad in the other. You might expect that if you spent such an extended period in 12 different households, what you would gather is 12 different ideas about how to raise children. There would be the strict parents and the lax parents and the hyper-involved parents and the mellow parents and on and on. What Leroux found, however, is something much different. There seemed to be only 2 parenting philosophies, and they divided almost perfectly along class lines. The wealthier parents raised their kids one way, and the poorer parents raised their kids another way. The wealthier parents were heavily involved in their children's free time, shuttling them from one activity to the next, quizzing them about their coaches and teammates. One of the well-off children Leroux followed played on a baseball team, 2 soccer teams, a swim team, and a basketball team in the summer, played in an orchestra, and took piano lessons. That kind of intensive scheduling was almost entirely absent from the lives of the poor children. Play, for them, wasn't soccer practice twice a week. It was making up games outside with their siblings and other kids in the neighborhood. What a child did was considered by his or her parents as something separate from the adult world and not particularly consequential. One girl from a working-class family, Katie Brindle, sang in a choir after school. But she signed up for it herself and walked to choir practice on her own. Leroux writes, "What Mrs. Brindle doesn't do that is routine for middle-class mothers is view her daughter's interest in singing as a signal to look for other ways to help her develop that interest into a formal talent. Similarly, Mrs. Brindle does not discuss Katie's interest in drama or express regret that she cannot afford to cultivate her daughter's talent. Instead, she frames Katie's skills and interests as character traits. Singing and acting are part of what makes Katie, Katie. She sees the shows her daughter puts on as cute and as a way for Katie to get attention." The middle-class parents would talk things through with their children, reasoning with them. They didn't just issue commands. They expected their children to talk back to them, to negotiate, to question adults in positions of authority. If their children are doing poorly, the wealthier parents challenge teachers. They intervene on behalf of their kids. One child Leroux follows just misses qualifying for a gifted program. Her mother arranges for her to be retested privately, petitions the school, and gets her daughter admitted.